Part 3. The Opening of the Mouth. Chapter 17. Echoed Souls. Blood and Sand. A Good Man. It took Ahriman and his companions another 6 hours to reach their destination. They traversed rugged haunches of mountain landscapes, great swathes of forest and vast bodies of polluted sludge that had once been glitter-sheened lakes. Acidic rain had poured down the mountains, poisoning the waters and laying waste to an ecosystem already reeling from centuries of global war. Flammable vapours leaked from the bedrock, and the mountain rocks were hazed with imminent ignition. The Tupolev lancers matched the punishing battle pace of the legionaries, riding their iron steeds along hardpan military roads that crisscrossed the devastated landscape of blackened wrecks, fire-gutted settlements, and smouldering pyres of corpses stacked like cordwood. Bon Giovanni led the way, threading a path through the thousands of imperial camps spread around the burning Yasolti refinery fields as best he could, angling a course higher into the peaks surrounding Mount Kithaeron. A vast city of rusted booster cradles glimpsed on the western horizon was identified as Megara, the first oathing city for the regiments of the Old Hundred before they shipped off-world to begin the conquest of the solar system. Bon Giovanni explained the city had been quarantined after militant anti-unity cells released a rapacious gene plague that fused living tissue and inanimate matter in hideous ways. The city was soon lost to sight as the mountains rose around them, and the higher they travelled, the more terror opened up to them. Far to the east and south were wide valleys that once ran with meandering rivers, but which were now arid dust canyons. The brooding twilight of smog boiling from the refineries behind them filtered the failing sunlight through a haze of toxic layers. The war-ravaged majesty of humanity's birthrock was intoxicating. Striated bands of petrocarbon storms raging in the ionosphere, the glittering spires of a distant missile launch facility, ice-filled shell craters in wastelands of petrified forests, clashing magnetic boreali to the east where fleets of transports plied the shipping lanes running between Terra and its orbital plates. Ahriman still found it strange that such beauty could be found in wanton destruction. It was a contradiction that had seen brother set against brother since the first primate raised a bone club to dash out the brains of its fellow. His eyes were drawn up towards the distant shadow of a matte-black leviathan hanging in the clouds, and attended by a fleet of gravitic tenders. It seemed impossible that such a titanic craft could possibly remain airborne, and the sight of it triggered a flash of Corvidae foresight? A memory? Bon Giovanni's warriors lifted their lances and let out whooping yells in salute of the gargantuan ship. They called it the Lux Ferrum, and chanted its name over and over again, wishing it good hunting and safe travels. Eventually the convoy left the military roads and began climbing mountain paths that bore track marks of civilian transports. Their route followed a switchback higher and higher, eventually running through a jagged cleft between two peaks. Ahriman had never been to this place before, but recognised it from the description given by Camille Shivani. A thrill of anticipation travelled the length of his spine as he understood they were close to one of the shards of Magnus. The switchback pathway widened onto a plateau, shorn from the mountain by the detonation of a rogue shell. A trio of rugged cargo six haulers were parked in a semicircle, their hulls dusty from the climb and with canvas awnings strung between them to form a sheltered camp. Ahriman led them into the site, taking a moment to study the dozens of crates, hermetic specimen capsules, excavation equipment, numerous canvas tents and hab shelters arranged in an orderly, logical fashion. Four servitors looked up with vacant expressions as they approached, but quickly returned to their dormant state.
"This is it?" asked Tolbeck, standing before a doorway worked into the cliff face.
a massive trilithon formed of two vertical slabs and a lintel set atop them.
"How many other doorways going down the throat of the mountain do you think there are around here?"
snapped Hathor Mart.
"Of course this is it!"
The lancers dismounted and tethered their steeds to the trucks, an unnecessary and curiously anachronistic gesture. Bon Giovanni nodded to Araman as his men formed up with their rifles pulled in tight to their shoulders at the doorway.
"Go in and get them out," said Araman. "Ensure that nothing is damaged."
Yes, my lord,"
said Bon Giovanni, snapping down his visor. Lambent green photomic cursors slid across the horizontal vision slit.
"When they're clear, escort them back down the mountain to the Imperial lines," Araman added. "See to it quickly, but no harm is to come to them. Understood?"
"We'll get it done,"
Bon Giovanni assured him, chopping his hand towards the doorway, and Araman heard clicking chirrups over the vox pickups. The five lancers vanished into the darkness, stab lights swiping left and right as they went deeper into the mountain.
"Why are we letting those mortals go in first?" asked Tolbeck. "If you're right and one of the shards of Magnus is below, then we should be the ones to find it."
"If I am right, then we are in the midst of events that have mystified our Legion scholars for decades."
"What events?"
asked Sanact.
"Better you do not know," said Araman. "We walk a razored line, where even the slightest deviation could have grave ramifications."
Tolbeck stepped in close to Araman, his fists ablaze.
"More damn secrets, Araman!"
he hissed.
"Be warned, Tolbeck,"
said Sanact, his blades half drawn. The Pyrae adept rounded on the swordsman.
"Oh, what? You'll draw those pretty little blades fully, try to take me on? It'll take a better man than any of you to end my life."
"Simmer down,"
said Hathor Mart, placing a gauntlet on Tolbeck's shoulder guard. "There will be foes for your fire soon enough without having to turn it on your brothers." Tolbeck shrugged off Hathor Mart's hand, heading towards the trilithon doorway in the mountain.
"You wait here if you want, but I am going in,"
he said.
"Tolbeck, wait,"
called Araman. But the adept of the Pyrae ignored him and marched into the mountain.
"Oh, damn it.
Let's get after him before the fool ruins this entirely. Sanact, wait here. Make sure there are no further arrivals, and when those below return to the surface, ensure they are sent down the mountain alive."
Sanact nodded and drew his blades with a spinning flourish as Araman and Hathor Mart plunged into the mountain. Araman's auto-senses easily penetrated the dusty gloom of the tunnel, an ashlar-faced passageway leading to numerous galleries hung with caged lumens that fizzed and buzzed with sporadic power. He caught up with Tolbeck in a vaulted chamber of offering bowls and dusty statues as the passageway angled steeply downwards. It spiraled in an arc, descending to a depth of 200 meters. Araman heard arguing voices drift up from below, and irritation touched him that Bon Giovanni hadn't yet managed to clear the cavern. He pulled ahead of his battle brothers and reached the bottom of the passageway, entering a high-roofed shrine cavern. Twin statues of jade and gold with moonstone eyes pupilled with obsidian stood at the farthest end. 16 mortals in conservators' robes stood in numb incomprehension, their hands raised as the Chupolov lancers trained their rifles on them.
"Why are these civilians still here?"
asked Araman. No one answered, and Araman sighed.
"I asked a question,"
he said.
"We're clearing them now, lord,"
replied Bon Giovanni.
"Hurry."
The hussars began herding the bewildered mortals towards the chamber's exit. A few mumbled in protest, but their defiance was half-hearted, too cowed by the unexpected arrival of the Legiones Astartes. One man took a hesitant step towards Araman, holding out a holographic pass pad.
Please,
he said in desperation.
Please, we are licensed conservators, see?
The hologram bloomed to life, but Araman didn't give it a second glance. He knew it was genuine, but didn't care.
My lord, this is a profound discovery, said the man. It is beyond value. It should be preserved for the benefit of future generations. My team has the expertise, the right equipment too. Please, lord.
This area is not safe, said Araman. You will remove yourselves.
But
I have given you an order, civilian.
My lord, which legion do I have the honor of being protected by?
the 15th.
The man nodded. Clearly he knew who they were. Ahriman studied this man, feeling like he ought to know him, or maybe that he already did.
"What is your name?"
he asked, as the lancers led the rest of the mortals from the shrine, leaving only this solitary man behind. His eyes widened in awe as Hathor Mart and Tolbeck entered the chamber.
"What is your name?" repeated Ahriman.
Reluctantly, the man's eyes returned to looking up at him, and he replied,
"Horser, Lord. Caspar Horser, conservator, assigned to—"
"Is that a joke?" asked Hathor Mart.
"What?"
asked the man.
"Is that supposed to be a joke?"
I don't understand, Lord."
"You told us your name," pressed Hathor Mart with exasperation. "Was it supposed to be a joke? Is it some nickname?"
I don't understand. That's my name. Why would you think it's a joke?"
"Caspar Horser," said Ahriman,
again feeling that this name should have significance to him beyond the obvious.
"You don't understand the reference."
The man called Horser shook his head.
"No one's ever..."
Ahriman turned his head and glanced at his companions before fixing his attention squarely on Horser.
"Clear the area."
Horser nodded and eased past Ahriman.
"Once the security of this area can be guaranteed," said Ahriman, "your team may be permitted to resume its duties. You will evacuate to the safe zone and await notification."
Horser nodded, fleeing past Tolbeck and Hathor Mart to rejoin his comrades. When the man was gone, an invisible weight seemed to lift from Ahriman's shoulders, as if a moment of great import had passed before him in a fogged mirror. He'd sensed some connection between them, but no matter how he reached for it, the truth slithered from his grasp. A moment of silence stretched as the three adepts of the Thousand Suns stared up at the towering statues before them, each finding different meaning in the stylized expressions carved in the stone by ancient hands.
"So, we're here," said Tolbeck. "Now what?"
Ahriman nodded towards the statues.
"These conservators dared not damage these statues to learn what lay behind them, and what they were protecting," he said. "We will not make that same mistake."
"Are you suggesting what I think you're suggesting?" asked Hathor Mart.
Ahriman nodded and raised his hands. Ether light ignited.
"How are your Raptora powers?"
Every one of the Vorax and Ursarax opened fire at the same instant. A blitzing storm of lightning and volkite filled the arena, each automaton's aim perfectly aligned to pass through where the shard of Magnus stood, or harmlessly out of their circle if it were somehow to miss. A heartbeat later, Biarki dropped to one knee and slammed his fist against the ground. Fault lines shot from the point of impact, and a deafening shockwave buckled the air as a freezing pyre engulfed Magnus in a geyser of razored ice shards. The Primarch reeled, and his bellow of agony was music to Promus's ears. The weapons fire of the cybernetics was a distraction only, a sleight of hand to obscure the true assault. Biarki's ice was blinding, and Promus charged through the coruscating psychic storm towards Magnus. Needles of ice sliced the surface of his plate. His auto-senses were hazed with frost and stormlight, but he needed no mortal senses to see the Crimson King. The Primarch's soul shard was a twisting titan of blinding illumination, the phosphorus silhouette of a giant. Promus leapt and slashed his sword in a high, decapitating strike. A risky cut, but one that could end this fight before it truly began. His searing blade cut the ice-filled air. Magnus swayed aside, a fractional movement that would have been impossible for a being of flesh and blood, but this was no mortal opponent. Promus's blade passed a hair's breadth from Magnus's neck. The Primarch spun on his heel as Promus landed, ducking to hammer his elbow into the librarian's flank. Burnished warplates splintered under the awful force. Ribs broke, and Promus felt bone fragments gouge the toughened meat of his lungs. The impact drove the breath from him, but he rode the blow and brought his sword back down in a lightning-fast reverse stroke. Magnus parried it with his kopesh, hooking his blade's haft under Promus's guard to hammer its pommel into the former ultramarine's chin. Promus's head snapped back, his body tracing a perfect parabola as he flew through the air. Sinews strained to breaking point as his helmet split down its center line. The crystalline matrix in his psi-hood shattered. He slammed into the sands, his vision a mire of static and fractured warning icons. Promus blinked away the savage pain and reached up to tear off his ruined helm. The heat of Aghoru assailed him, even over the freezing residue of Biaki's power. Cold filled him, and he heard wolves howling. Ultramarian discipline asserted itself, and he pushed himself to his feet. Gunfire and the clash of steel filled the arena. The actinic bite of the immaterium slithered over his skin. Biaki's warriors and Yasu Nagasena circled Magnus, like pack predators, who, having run their prey to ground, were revelling in the last moment before the kill. That the wolves allowed a mortal to fight alongside them was surprising. That he yet lived was doubly so. They rushed the Primarch en masse, going at him with no urge to duel or trade barbs, but simply to kill. Only Nagasena fought with finesse, but even his attacks were the purest expressions of simplicity and directness. Magnus reeled under their brutal ferocity. Lights spilled from where each weapon struck, but none could land a killing blow. Magnus struck out, and Svavnir Rackwolf went down on one knee, blood sheeting from his left leg. A bone-crunching boot to the chest hurled him back 10 meters, his barbed harpoon spinning from his grip. Biaki fought with his frostblade and winter's lightning at his fingertips. Forking blasts punched into Magnus, spitting flares of warp essence into vapour. Gialothnir Hellblind swung his great axe two-handed like a veteran headsman. Where the wolves were pack predators, Nagasena was a striking snake, darting in to attack with pinpoint accuracy and blows that would slay a mortal thrice over. Magnus fought each in turn, spinning, blocking, and attacking like the avenging sun himself. The Primarch caught the haft of Hellblind's descending weapon in one hand and jerked it forwards. He pulled Hellblind off balance, but the wolf refused to relinquish his weapon. Magnus hacked his kopesh down. Promus threw himself into the fight as Magnus's blade clove into Hellblind's chest. Searing electrical fire blazed from the wound, and the Fenrisian roared in anger. Even as he fell, he cursed Magnus. "No!" yelled Biaki, and Magnus laughed at his pain. Biaki, Nagasena, and Promus stood alone before the Crimson King, and the former Ultramarine realized how grossly they had underestimated the Primarch's martial prowess. So much was made of his scholarly devotion to learning that they had forgotten the Lord of Prospero was still a warrior of sublime and terrible wrath. Magnus read the realization in his eyes and grinned.
"Well, is this how you thought this would end?" said Magnus.
Promus drew upon the iron discipline of Macragge and allowed the searing energies of the warp into his body.
"This isn't ended,"
he said, thrusting his sword into the sky. A whipping, crackling arc of vivid blue energy lanced from the heavens towards his blade, the power to slay demons and rip the fabric of space-time asunder. The energy never reached him. It bent aside at the last instant, drawn into Magnus's outstretched fist.
"You are a fool if you think you can best me in a contest of psychic mastery, Dio Promus,"
said Magnus, his body a lightning rod at the heart of a storm. The Primarch thrust his fist at Promus, and the Librarian's warplate split as enormous crushing energies seized it. His plastron buckled as it compressed. Biaki and Nagasena renewed their attack. The Sigilite's man rolled left, slashing his blade at the Primarch's hamstrings. Biaki arced behind Magnus and called the powers of Fenris to his sword. It blazed with the coldest fires imaginable.
"For the spear, inviter!"
he yelled, and thrust his sword hard and straight into Magnus's back. The blade burst from the center of the Primarch's chest, and an eruption of prismatic light filled the arena. Magnus spun and brought his kopesh down in a brutal arc towards the rune priest's skull. Biaki roared and bared his fangs in the face of death. And a pair of smoking wolves, one tar black and the other snowdrift white, unfolded from the air beside him. They leapt at the descending blade, ripping Magnus's arm backwards. They savaged the Primarch of the Thousand Suns, clawing and tearing and biting. Light burned from Magnus's wounds, but he spoke a word of power, and the twin wolves exploded into cindered ash.
"Time to end this farce," said Magnus, his body erupting in a burst of ether fire.
He thrust his arms out to the side, and a detonation of kinetic force billowed outwards in an irresistible psychic shockwave. It threw Promus, Nagasena, and Biaki backwards like leaves in a hurricane. Promus hit the ground hard, 20 meters from the Primarch. Behind him, the two Magos of the Mechanicum watched the fight in the shadow of Olgir Widdowson and the Remembrancer, Lemuel Gauman. He saw Sister Caesaria speak briefly to the wolf before she turned and rushed towards the battle. He shook his head, trying to push himself upright.
"Magos!" he shouted. "Shoot! Thrawn, shoot!"
Magnus laughed, and Promus felt the heat of the Primarch's boot pin him to the earth.
"You brought automata because you thought they would be the perfect soldiers to fight me.
They are loyal to a fault, yes, but you forget one thing. No matter how much you surround them with iron, steel, and plastic, there remains a kernel of human weakness at their core." Promus twisted to look over his shoulder at the painted battle automata. Crackling, blood-red fire flickered around each cybernetic warrior as it turned and brought its guns to bear on their once masters.
"Fire," said Magnus.
The Thousand Suns plunged into the heart of the mountain, following a snaking path as it wound its way downwards for hundreds of meters. The thought that he trod pathways not known to mortals for over 30 millennia was intoxicating to Ahriman, and even the thought of the destruction of priceless statuary behind them did not trouble him overmuch.
"You are sure he's down here?" said Hathelmart.
"I am," said Ahriman, with more certainty than he felt.
"You said that about Committee Sona,"
pointed out Tolbeck, though there was none of the bellicosity normally present in his remark.
"We found Mistress Shivani there. She was a link in the chain that has led us to this place. Surely you can see the cosmic resonance in that, Tolbeck?"
"Of course they can," sighed Tolbeck,
the fire from his palms casting a flickering orange glow onto the walls.
"I know you all think the Pyrai are simpletons because our powers are used for destruction more often than not. Yes, we are a simple direct fellowship, but we are Thousand Suns, and Masters Memphia and Scythego wrought no fools when they established our cult. I understand that nothing of our journey will be easy, but it vexes me not to see the path."
"Trust me, brother, it vexes the Corvidae more."
Tolbeck grunted with laughter, a sound so incongruous that it brought them all up short. A sense of brotherhood swept through Ahriman, a feeling he had not truly felt since before the Council of Nakia. It seemed his brothers felt that same confraternity, even the normally viperous Hathelmart.
"We are a fine host, are we not?"
said the Adept of the Pavoni. "We were made brothers by gene rites, wrought into warriors by necessity, and made companions by the vagaries of betrayal. Who among us would ever have seen fit to put us together as the saviours of the Legion?"
"Our father did," said Ahriman, holding his hand out to Hathelmart. "And I would have it no other way. We are all here, brothers. Our fates forever bound until our deaths. I would die for any of you."
Hathelmart ignored Ahriman's proffered hand and simply said,
"An eye for you all, brothers."
"Yes, would I," said Tolbeck.
With their brotherhood renewed, the legionaries pressed onwards. Ahriman ran his fingers along the moist walls, cut with angular letters of ancient provenance. Mere graffiti, or the writings of a wandering king? More pressingly, Ahriman sought an answer to why he had felt the need to speak words of brotherhood he did not feel. Power was at work here, but it was a subtle power, smoothing out the rougher edges of their abrasive psyches. He tried not to let hope get ahead of him, remembering his disappointment when the mission to Committee Sona had not yielded a fragment of their gene sire.
"A question occurs," said Hathelmart, breaking his train of thought.
"What?"
"Does anyone know exactly when our father and Perturabo came this way? They explored these mountains together, did they not? Searching for the very place in which we walk?"
They did, agreed Araman.
The Primarch never told me the exact dates, only that it was in the aftermath of the Asalti refinery fields burning. The fires spread to the mountain, and the entire range burned for decades.
Then could we wait here? Asked Hathormat. Perhaps we might warn them both of what is to come.
And they would believe us, said Tolbeck.
If anyone might, it would be them. Araman halted and shook his head.
The Corvidae once held great conclaves to debate such matters, asking whether it was possible or even desirable to change the past. Or, even if it was possible, could anyone ever know it had happened? Or would they simply assimilate the new timeline as their own? Those who believed it possible spoke of the great travellers Titor and Amberson, and the great disasters of the past they were said to have averted. Their opponents spoke of how the actions attributed to those travellers almost always resulted in timelines more chaotic than those they were said to have replaced. Besides, Magnus already tried to warn the Emperor of Horus Lupercal's betrayal, and that brought the Sixth to Prospero as our executioners. No, Hathor, if an earlier incarnation of our father is close by, we should not seek him out. The consequences are never worth what transient benefit we might think to gain. Hathormat nodded, but Araman saw the notion of seeking to alter the future's path still held appeal for the warrior. They delved into the mountain for another hour before finally reaching its deepest vault, a hexagonal library chamber, with every wall, aside from the one they had entered, filled with bookshelves that groaned with the weight of the knowledge carried upon them. At the exact centre of the chamber, heaped with books and scrolls, was a circular table. A man was reading there, and he looked up in welcome as the three legionaries entered. His robe was crimson, edged in gold, and with a coif of silver mail at his shoulders. His features were handsome, those of a great king, and his raven hair was pulled into a long scalp lock that fell to the small of his back. A long braided beard hung from his chin, bound by three copper rings. "Who are you?" asked Araman,
as the man carefully closed his book and put it face down on the table. He held a hand out to a chair opposite him, a chair Araman swore hadn't been there only moments before.
"I am King Cadmus," said the man. "Mistress Shivani warned me you would be coming, Azek Araman."
Lemuel had once endured an electrical storm on the Azaka-Tonnerre ferroplains of Nordafrik, travelling east with a convoy of desperate people on the trail of an elusive Sangoma, said to have miraculous powers. A sudden darkening of the sky had been the first warning, a gathering expeditionary fleet passing overhead in low orbit, its sheer mass of steel disrupting already volatile atmospherics with electromagnetic squalls. The convoy's mounted guides scattered, putting as much distance between the metal-rich environment of the convoy and themselves as possible. Deafening peals of thunder shook the earth, and a heartbeat later, the storm raced in on stalking legs of lightning. It filled the air with light and fury. The first vehicles were incinerated in a blinding flash of magnesium-bright light. Explosions marched down the convoy as fuel cells detonated, and external promethium tanks exploded in whooshing plumes of fire. Screams of panic were drowned out by relentless whip-cracks of lightning. Lemuel and his fellow pilgrims ran for cover, but the storm was unrelenting, and there was no shelter to be found. 9 hours later, Lemuel and two others crawled out from under a pyre of blackened corpses. He had relived that night 1,000 times in his dreams. Never had he thought he would re-experience it. Olgier Widdowson lay sprawled atop him, the sheer mass of the space wolf's body pinning him in place. He didn't know if the warrior was alive or dead. The last thing Lemuel had seen was Widdowson's smoking warplate as it barreled into him and sheets of blazing lightning erupting from the cybernetics. He'd hit the ground hard, crying out in pain and terror as the braces supporting his legs buckled under the legionary's weight. He was lying on his front, struggling for breath. Lemuel couldn't see what was happening. Why had the automata opened fire on them? He heard roars of pain and the awful stench of roasting flesh. Lemuel wept as he felt the crushing claustrophobia of being pinned beneath the dying bodies on a Zaka Tonnerre. His breath came in shallow hikes, his lungs unable to inflate. Olgier Widdowson was slowly crushing the life out of him. He struggled to pull himself free, but Widdowson was hundreds of kilos of dead weight. He heard someone call his name and looked up. Grey fog hazed his eyes, his vision narrowing to a spot of light in the far distance. Was this death? Lemuel had always feared this moment. He had raged against his wife's terminal illness, traversing the globe many times over in search for a cure for her sickness. Now that death was coming for him, he found he was not afraid. Was this what Malika had known when she begged him not to waste their last days in a futile search for a cure? A grey shadow moved before him. He couldn't see it clearly. Lemuel struggled to focus, blinking away tears. A young boy reaching for him, a tiny hand extended. His eyes were empty and dead, a purple-yellow weal around his neck where his mother had strangled him.
I as good as put my hands on his neck.
The boy reached out to him.
What was he called?
A slew of names flashed into Lemuel's mind, unknown names, places, people or things he could not tell.
Pharos? Pharaon? No, Ferris. Yes, Ferris, that was it. Leave me,
hissed Lemuel with his last breath.
I killed you.
No,
said a voice too deep and too resonant to be that of a youth.
You may yet save us all.
The boy grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and pulled. Astonishingly, Lemuel felt himself moving, dragged out from beneath the crushing weight of Widdowson's prostrate form. Lemuel fought against the boy's strength, knowing that only more pain awaited him in this world. Breath heaved back into Lemuel's lungs, a sucking draught of electrically charged air. Lightning danced around him, a crackling dome of it rippling overhead. His vision blurred with the rush of oxygen to his brain. He stumbled, but the boy held him upright. No, not a boy. The warrior of the Thousand Suns sat him upright, ripping open his tunic. Agony flared along his legs and up his spine. Lemuel blinked away tears of pain and twisted in his savior's grip. Muttering to himself, the warrior moved his hands across Lemuel's chest as if searching for injuries. Lemuel felt wetness and looked down. Blood covered his skin, dripping down his chest from where the warrior had touched him.
What are you doing?
He gasped.
Hold still,
said the legionary, glancing over his shoulder.
I don't have long.
Lemuel followed his gaze, and his heart hammered in terror. In the heart of the arena, Magnus was ablaze with light. The Crimson King floated, with his feet angled downwards, a meter above sand that was even now turning to glass. His armour burned like molten gold, too bright to look upon. His arms were outstretched, and light flared from them like the wings of an avenging angel come down from some celestial realm to wreak vengeance upon a disloyal kingdom. Any semblance of corporeality was shed now at battle's end. This Magnus needed no flesh. He was immaterial energy unbound. And this was but a shard of a greater whole. Bodies lay strewn around the Primarch. Bodies of flesh and blood, bodies of iron and ceramite, mortal, mechanicum, and legion. The wolf pack lay broken. Sister Caesarea lay still, her armour a smoking molten ruin. Even Promus and Negasena were down. Dead or alive, Lemuel couldn't tell. The legionary shook him, his gaze unrelenting.
Are you a good man?
Asked the Thousand Suns legionary.
What?
Quickly! Are you a good man?
No,
said Lemuel.
Were you ever a good man?
Once, maybe. I don't know,
said Lemuel. The warrior shrugged and said,
For both our sakes, I hope that will be enough.
He hauled Lemuel to his feet as Magnus drifted towards them.
Menkaura, said the Crimson King. Of course it would be you.
Who else of my sons might glimpse what was to come?
Only Ahriman, or maybe Amon, said Menkaura.
And Lemuel felt the tip of the legionary's thumb tracing a cursive pattern on the back of his neck, an ever-decreasing spiral.
But they are too blinded by love to see the truth. And even had they seen what I saw, they would not have had the courage to try to stop you.
Magnus circled in the air, surveying the carnage around him.
Malkador's finest could not do that, he said. What makes you think you can?
Because, like you, I was a diligent student, said Menkaura. And I, too, have delved into prescribed texts.
Lemuel twisted in Menkaura's grip, lifting his hands to shield them from the star-bright radiance of the Primarch's soul shard. He had sat in the presence of Magnus the Red before, heard him tell tales of lost Prospero. But this was not the same person. This was no grandfatherly raconteur. This was the fiery aspect of Magnus, consumed by anger, bitterness, and hate.
Please,
he sobbed, hearing Menkaura whisper strange words that made him flinch.
Don't.
What is that?
Said Magnus, his form rippling with ether fire, and his eye narrowing as he caught the scent of something awry.
The Malus Caedicium. In servitutum abduco, began Menkaura. Magnus flew at his son in a rage. Don't you dare!
Killing light blazed from his clawed hands. Menkaura pressed his thumb hard into the back of Lemuel's neck, completing the spiral pattern he had been tracing.
I bind thee fast forever into this host,
yelled Menkaura. Lemuel screamed as Magnus swept them into his fiery embrace. He felt himself falling. His will tore away, unhoused from its seat of consciousness, a deposed king of his own flesh. Lemuel was falling, falling into himself, dropping into an abyssal chasm from which there could be no return. But he did not fall alone. He fell with a fiery angel.